Osiris.
Hi, this is Lucas Nelson with Promise of the Real, and the podcast you're listening to is part of the Osiris Network. Osiris is creating a community that connects people like you with podcasts and live experiences about artists and topics you love. Sign up for the newsletter at osirispod.com to stay in the loop.
Louis Billy Ark got a gopher wood. The flood it came in, the ark it stood. And those arks are moving, a moving, a moving. And those arks are moving, a moving along. Who built the ark?
Oh, no, no.
Now who built the ark?
Oh, no,
my lord. And those arks are moving, a moving, a moving. And those arks are moving, a moving along. March the animals two by two, the hippopotamus and the kangaroo. And those arcs are moving, a moving, a moving. Those arcs are moving, a moving along. Who built the ark?
Oh, no, no.
Now who built the ark?
Oh, no,
my lord. No arcs are moving, a moving, a moving. Those arcs are moving, a moving along. Noah and the devil playing seven up. The devil win the ark and Noah wouldn't give it up. And those arks are moving, a moving, a moving. And those arks are moving, a moving along. Who built the ark?
Oh, Noah, Noah.
Who built the ark? Oh, Noah, my lord. And those arks are moving, a moving, a moving. And those arks are moving, a moving along. Noah sent a dove to find dry land. The dove came back with a big grain of sand. And those arks are moving, and moving, and moving. Those arks are moving, and moving along. Who built the ark?
Oh, Noah,
Noah. Now who built the ark?
Oh, Noah, my lord.
And those arks are moving, and moving, and moving. Those arks are moving, and moving along. Had no hat, had no crown, looked like a poor man living in town.
And those arks are moving, a moving, a moving. And those arks are moving, a moving along.
Who built the ark?
Oh, Noah, Noah.
Now who built the ark?
Oh, Noah, my lord.
And those arks are moving, a moving, a moving. Those arks are moving, a moving along. Had no buggy, had no spokes. I looked like Grandpap and all of his folks.
And those arks are moving, a moving, a moving. And those arks are moving, a moving along.
Who built the ark?
Oh, no, and no.
Now who built the ark?
Oh, no, and
my lord.
And those arks are moving, a moving, a moving.
And those arks are moving, a moving along. Had no hat, had no brim, looked like a crow's nest swinging on a limb.
And those arks are moving, a moving, a moving.
Those arks are moving, a moving along. Who built the ark?
Oh, no, and no.
Now who built the ark?
Oh, no, and my lord.
Those arks are moving, a moving, a moving. Those arks are moving, a moving along. Tell Sister Mary.
Welcome to RTN Theology number 8. My name is Bob Crawford. And today I'm excited to welcome to our show Catherine O'Donnell, the faculty head and associate professor of history at Arizona State University. She recently released a book entitled Elizabeth Seton, American Saint, and really excited that she's got another one in the works, The History of the Jesuits in the United States. Today we're going to talk about Catholics in early American history. Catherine O'Donnell, welcome to RTN Theology.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I'd like to set the table for Elizabeth Seton. And I think, you know, on this show, we've talked to John Fea before, and we've talked a lot about Protestant American history. You know, the Protestants played, many would argue that America is a Protestant nation. Mm-hmm. But the Catholics have been here all along. I mean, going back to the earliest settling of North America, but they began to take on a different role. I'd say post French Indian War. Can you maybe for our listeners talk about how Catholics were introduced into the United States during like the settling period of the nation prior to the Revolution?
Absolutely. So Catholics enter what would become the United States through a number of different empires, right? The French Empire, in sort of northern New England, mainly in Canada, but including parts of what would become the United States, the Spanish Empire, right, the Southwest, California. But also, and I think this is what most surprises people, in parts of the 13 colonies. And where they mainly went was Maryland, which was founded in great measure as a kind of refuge for Catholics, the Calverts, who were a convert family, chartered the colony. So there are Catholics in Maryland from the very beginning. They lose control of the colony fairly early on politically, but they're always socially and economically powerful there. And in fact, part of that tradition was a fairly tolerant, pluralist approach to religions, because Catholics in that context understood that they were not going to successfully be a state religion, and so worked to create a colony in which a variety of forms of Christianity, right, not all religions, but forms of Christianity could find a home. So they are there from the beginning, they actually participate in great numbers in the Revolution. If you want to move ahead to the American Revolution, Catholics in Maryland, and by that point they'd moved into Pennsylvania, parts of what would become Kentucky and so forth, tended to favor the cause of independence.
Was there a hostility towards Catholics? I know in New England in particular, the Pope's Day, November 5th, the anniversary of Guy Fawkes, what they would call Guy Fawkes Day. So in New England, you know, we think of the Pilgrims, we think of John Winthrop, we think of the Massachusetts Bay Colony, Congregationalists, this really Puritan part of the country. They didn't like the Catholics, right?
Right, no. I mean, Catholics were everything that the British did not want to be, did not really want to have in their territory. It was this sort of remarkable antithesis of everything British, and that transferred to the colonists, to most of the colonists who were, as you absolutely correctly point out, overwhelmingly Protestant. So Catholics were thought to lack the kind of independence of mind that British people considered an element of Britishness. They were thought to follow their priests or their pope, and that not only made them not kind of good individuals in this view, but it also made them unpatriotic, because the argument went that their first loyalty was always to this guy in Rome, not to whomever their leader was. And so this is a kind of political argument. It's a spiritual argument that Catholics did not have an individual relationship to God, but only an individual through clergy. And it's also very much a geopolitical argument. So that Catholics were thought to be this kind of potential fifth column, that who would align with the French or the Spanish, or really anyone who came by who was seeking to harm British interests.
And it didn't help in that part of the country, because you had Canada was French Canadian, and it was not far away. I mean, it was only hours away from Massachusetts. So
it was not far away, and it came closer in raids. Right? I mean, this is not simply kind of an imagined threat. There actually were French alliances with indigenous peoples in wartime, and sometimes there were raids on New England colonies. So there was a real component to what was also kind of a set of cultural attitudes.
I would have to recommend to our listeners John Demos, The Unredeemed Captive, if you want to get an idea of the tension between Catholics and Protestants and this time in American history. That is a great historical narrative to go to. So let me ask you about Pope's Day. I love telling my friends about Pope's Day, because, you know, me and my son, we go out and we play, we shoot basketball, we play horse, right? Or we try to play go fish, me and my kids and my wife. But on Pope's Day in New England, the kids played a game called Break the Pope's Neck. So,
right.
So maybe just as a way to emphasize this this Protestant Catholic hostility, maybe tell our listeners a little bit about what would happen in Boston on November 5th before the American Revolution in the years prior. Yeah.
Absolutely. And so the reference was to this effort to blow up the British Parliament, which had failed and was connected to what the British felt very strongly was a broad Catholic conspiracy. So Pope's Day is the annual celebration of that failure and of the fact that the British were not Catholic. And in addition to these children's games, adults would make effigies of the Pope, kind of Pope puppets, and march them through the streets, burn them publicly. There would be all kinds of toasts, some of them rude, and after you do enough toasts, everything is rude, right? again, kind of attacking the papacy and attacking Catholics. And this went forward through the Revolutionary period. George Washington, as I recall, actually was uneasy about these celebrations during the Revolution, right? Because when you're fighting a war, you do not want denominational divisions among your troops. And Washington, in general, made a point throughout his kind of career, also as a statesman, of reaching out to the Catholic communities. But this was absolutely part of the fabric of British life and of life in the colonies. If you were British, you were not Catholic. You did make fun of the Pope, burn the Pope in effigy. And that was just absolutely unquestioned.
A guy named is it Brennan McConnell?
Brendan McConville, absolutely. Brendan McConnell,
a book called "The King's Three Faces," and he makes the argument, if I recall, that in the run up to the Revolution, the people, and particularly in New England, tried to begin to associate King George with the Pope.
Yes, absolutely.
When King George, he was not a Catholic.
No, he was not a Catholic. So that kind of weird connection comes from the idea that any kind of centralized, utterly illegitimate authority was in the end Catholic, right? So as colonists began to understand the British monarchy as something separate from them, something that they believed made independent thought and kind of dignified manhood impossible, then it's going to get kind of hotwired to their vision of the papacy, because that's the role the papacy played. And so when New Yorkers pull down this gilded statue of George III that they had really just erected like 20 years earlier, there is a great sense that they're attacking George III, but they're also attacking what would be called like a crypto pope or a hidden pope. It's pretty wild, but that's how cultural insults work often, right? Through these analogies that follow the logic of the culture, even if a couple of hundred years later, you have to work pretty hard to see what that was.
And we see it in our present day and in our current politics, I think, in some ways. Mm-hmm. So getting back to George Washington, November 5th, 1775, he's, I guess, just recently taken over as the general of the Continental Army. And he puts out a statement for all the troops saying, hey, Guy Fawkes Day, we're not going to tolerate any anti-popery, none of those games, none of the drinking, none of the carrying on. We need the French on our side. So does this begin the turn, if you will, through the Revolution of maybe courting the French rather than and downplaying animosity towards Catholics?
Yeah, I think that is a wonderful moment to bring out, and it absolutely is part of this pivot in which leaders are saying, you know who we're fighting here? We're fighting the British Protestant monarch. And it is possible, and then later in the war, it was the fact that the French Catholic monarch is going to help. And in addition to that French support, there were Catholics within the colonies who were enlisting, serving in the militia and in the Continental Army. There was a Catholic signer of the Declaration of Independence, Charles Carroll, who was, of course, a Marylander, right? Part of this Maryland tradition. And it gives an opening then for Catholics themselves to argue in this period and directly afterward that Catholicism is a form of Christianity, which was not something readily accepted at the time, and that as a form of Christianity, it's not an enemy to the Republic, but part of what will make the Republic succeed.
So the Continental Congress says, we need to get Canada on our side. They're also being oppressed by the British, and they're Catholic, and they can't practice their faith in Canada. So they try to send a contingent of Continental Congressmen. Charles Carroll of Carrollton was one of them. Benjamin Franklin was one of them. I believe John Carroll, who was Charles Carroll's cousin and a Jesuit, was also a part of this little committee that went to the French Canadians and said, hey, you know, come on, join our side. But the French Canadians, they have good memories, right?
Yes. So this is This is a kind of brainwave of the Congress, and they enlist John Carroll, who would become the first bishop and then the first archbishop of the United States, but who at that moment is a member of the Jesuit order, which had just been suppressed, right? Because Catholic history is as complicated as any sort of imperial history. They send them to Canada, and the argument does not fly because French Canadians know exactly what you and I were just discussing, which is that American colonists had, if anything, increased their kind of rhetorical animosity toward Catholics as the imperial crisis occurred. And they also know that after the British were successful in the French and Indian War, the British government had extended toleration to Catholicism in what had been French Canada and what was now British Canada. And the British argument for doing that then was exactly the argument for people such as George Washington, including Catholics, right? Which is that in order for this political project to work, this big, messy colony of Canada, we need people to be included rather than excluded. So the French Canadians, in short, felt more comfortable under the British government than they did under the potential government of these people who hated the Pope and were still, you know, were still as overtly hostile as ever.
So what is the attitude culturally in the colonies post-Saratoga when the French get on board, when the French come on our side?
Yeah. The way I would describe it is anti-Catholicism or anti-popery, to use the word of the time. I once had a student say, what did they have against popery? But it's popery. That doesn't go away. It remains kind of a tool in the toolkit, but it recedes in importance. And the hostility toward the British government, the gratitude toward people such as Lafayette, right, and the sense of inclusion of Catholics fighting in the armies, that becomes more important. It becomes more important culturally. And you also see kind of restrictions on Catholics fading out of state constitutions, for example, that are written during this period. Pope's Day becomes something that is much less celebrated. And in fact, in a kind of odd coincidence, churches of the first sort of official Catholic church in Manhattan is dedicated right around Pope's Day, and nobody gives them a hard time. This is fairly shortly after the Revolution. But those cultural associations, those memories remain. And so when in the 1830s and 40s you have a great surge of Catholic migration to the United States, you have an increased sense of threat demographically, economically, politically, that kind of ugliness, that kind of anti-Catholic sentiment and rhetoric is going to come back out of the toolbox, and it's going to become an important part of American history again.
It seems like when in times of stress, be it financial stress or cultural change, societies tend to go back to their old boogeymen, and the Catholics play that role again and again in American history. So Washington developed an affinity for these Catholics, like men like John Carroll and Charles Carroll. And the French weren't the only Catholic nation that were supporting us, although they were the most out front about it. The Spanish were also trying to help us out in certain ways. There was a Spaniard who wasn't an official liaison or diplomat for the Spanish government, Don Juan Morales.
Yeah.
You familiar with him?
I don't have any research about him, but he is absolutely part of it. There's also, I think his name is Don Juan Stoughton, who is kind of a mixed Spanish and Irish descent, who's a merchant, who's important in New York. So there's absolutely kind of a set of diplomats, merchants who are Catholic, who favor the cause of independence, and who also are just kind of economically useful to elites. The expression "everyone's money is green" can be overused, but there is certainly a sense in which it is often simply practical to cooperate economically as well as politically, diplomatically, across cultural lines, across denominational lines, and you definitely see that.
Well, the one thing that the one point that I like to make with about Don Juan Morales is that he became very close. He and Washington had a strong affinity for one another, it appears, from what I've read, and that when he passed, there was a requiem mass at a Catholic church in Philadelphia, and members of the Continental Congress stepped foot in a Catholic church and took part in a mass to honor this man.
Yeah.
And at Absolutely. The time, 5 years before, it would be unheard of.
Absolutely. And this is I think this is something that Washington is not always given credit for. Washington also very assertively connected to the Jewish communities in the United States, to Catholic communities in the United States, and absolutely had a kind of pluralist, inclusive approach that was extraordinarily useful to his ability to draw together an American nation when really we were making this up as we went along, right? There wasn't such a thing. And he did draw the lines far more inclusively than I think a lot of leaders at the time would have.
Okay, so now I think we've set the table. It's post-revolution, and introduce Elizabeth Seton into our story.
Great. So Elizabeth, as I think of her, is actually born in New York in 1774, just as the American Revolution is starting. She's born into a loyalist family, actually. Her mother dies during the war. Her father remarries a woman who was very young and who never quite managed to mother her stepdaughters, which were Elizabeth and Elizabeth's sister. So Elizabeth grows up in a kind of a cosmopolitan milieu. So her father is nominally an Episcopalian, had been an Anglican, now an Episcopalian, but really not very interested in church, far more interested in science and medicine. And Elizabeth grows up in that world. She marries. She eventually has 5 children. And to kind of cut to the chase, her husband first goes bankrupt and then dies of tuberculosis, leaving Elizabeth an impoverished widow with five children. She's become interested in institutional Christianity during this period of kind of suffering. But her husband dies in Italy. She's with him. They'd gone on this desperate trip to try to save his health and his business. And she becomes deeply moved by what she sees of Catholicism there. She finds it kind of sustaining in a way she had not found Episcopalianism. And she converts.
So a couple things. You talk about her being having this cosmopolitan upbringing in New York City post-American Revolution. She lived on Wall Street for a short period of time, and she had some famous neighbors.
Yeah, she lived on Wall Street, which was then much more residential, and she had Alexander Hamilton down one end, she had Aaron Burr up the other end, and her husband was a very well-connected merchant. In fact, her husband and her father-in-law worked fairly closely with Alexander Hamilton during one of the new nation's first, but alas not last, financial panics. So she was a bit of a high flyer socially, and quite charming. She was known as a beauty, and that kind of comes out in portraits, even though they're very formal. She knew a lot of the people whose names have come down to us, who kind of shaped New York and shaped the country, and she enjoyed them. She was a witty conversationalist as well.
And it's not that she just suddenly had a conversion. She was on a spiritual journey her whole life.
I love that you put it that way. From her, and we have a ton, like it's an historian's dream, because she left letters and journals, and people left letters about her, and these wonderful Sisters of Charity who are part of the religious community Elizabeth founded have carefully preserved these across centuries. So, yes, so it looks like from her earliest days, Elizabeth, kind of on her own, because as I said, this is not coming from her family, wanted to feel the presence of God, wanted to have a sense of that immediacy. And she also loved to read philosophy. She loved Rousseau. She called him Dear JJ for Jean-Jacques. And for all of her childhood, adolescence, and into her young womanhood, kind of what we might call her spirituality or this hunger for God's presence existed separately from her intellectual pursuits and to an extent from her social world as well. It was not quite spiritual, but not religious, right? This term that we use now, but it was a little bit of that. She was a little bit of a loner. And then the first kind of institutional home, Christian home that she found was in the Episcopalian church. And she loved that. She had a close relationship with a minister.
Hobart?
It was John Henry Hobart, who was a little bit controversial at the time. He was young, and this would not shock any of your modern listeners, but he preached without notes and in a kind of impassioned way and in this sort of genteel, quiet world of New York's Episcopalians. He was a bit much, but Elizabeth Seton loved him. Because he kind of offered something of this presence, right, that she had wanted. And also his version of Episcopalianism was pretty liturgically rich. But it was not as rich as what she found in Italy among Catholics. And she was perfectly aware. She'd been exposed to the kind of casual anti-Catholicism that still persisted, right, during the revolution and after that we've talked about. So she did not expect to have anything other than like a tourist's reaction to what she was seeing, almost a kind of eat, pray, love sort of look at these lovely people doing these things that I respect but would not do. But then she just kind of almost against her will finds herself moved when she's in a mass as a tourist. It occurs to her, I'm not really here as a tourist at this moment. I am moved as a spiritual seeker by what is going on around me and this desire for presence, right, that she'd always felt is fulfilled in Italian Catholic churches in a way that it never had been in the churches or the individual seeking of her youth.
And she goes to Italy because her husband is seeking a cure, seeking to be healed, correct? He's sick.
He has tuberculosis. Yes, he has tuberculosis, and his business is dying as well. And she writes that she knows their friends think that they're crazy. This is not going to work. And in fact, as soon as they get to Italy, they are quarantined. No one understands that tuberculosis is contagious, but the Italians have an inkling. And this is good for medical science, but it's terrible for the Seton family, because she, her husband, and their little 8-year-old daughter are quarantined in what is basically a lighthouse. It's like an uninsulated brick and stone building, literally out in the water. And they're kept there for a month, and his tubercular suffering just becomes more and more intense. It's excruciating to read her journal from this period. And they're finally let out after about a month, and he's dead within a week after that. So she's left in Italy in the care of a family who are Catholic, deeply Catholic, and who are merchant kind of associates of her late husband. She's there with her daughter. She expects that she'll be polite and she'll leave, and then Italy will just be the story she tells, right? Once upon a time, I was in Italy. And instead, because of her reaction to Catholicism, it becomes this pivot point in her life, but also really in the history of Catholicism in the United States, because she's such an influential figure.
So she comes back, and she's Catholic, and she comes back to everyone mourning the loss of her husband. His business is now gone. What is the reaction of her conversion to those around her, to those who knew her?
Oh my goodness, they are startled and in some cases angry. Now her circle are merchants, and many of them had dealings with Catholic merchants in the way I mentioned, but they still understand Catholicism as, at best, the religion of the past, right? A religion of superstition when people didn't know any better. It's not a religion you convert to. It's a religion you grow out of, right? That's their view. And they also feel, because Elizabeth comes back bringing one of this family with her, Antonio Felici, who's this merchant. He's married, but he's very dashing and handsome and charming.
Yeah, and she falls in love. What happened between them on the way back from Italy?
Yeah, this is the kind of unexpected and very human story. So Elizabeth, all her life, had strong relationships with men. She had a very good relationship with her father. She adored her husband. She had male friends. And I think after her husband's death, it doesn't strike her as unusual at all that she would have a friendship with these merchant brothers. One is Filippo and one is Antonio. And her friendship with Filippo remains in a kind of, acceptable, non-threatening format. But Antonio becomes to her the source of happiness and comfort, and in a way that unsettles her profoundly. And she cuts off communication with him even when she's in Italy, because she is worried that she is falling in love with him. And I think that was possible because it seemed impossible, right? I mean, she was deeply mourning her husband, whom she had loved. And I think it was impossible to her that she would fall for someone else until she realized she was excited when she saw him. She found herself thinking about him. So she cuts off that relationship, but then she decides that Antonio is not a romantic attachment, but is instead her connection to Catholicism. And the excitement she feels when she sees Antonio is her excitement about this new faith. But then on the ship home, he's sent back with her as a kind of chaperone. And because the Felici, this family, know perfectly well when she gets off this ship, people are going to try to talk her out of being Catholic. So Antonio is sent back with her, and then something else happens on the ship, and it's not clear what. And it, I'm sure, was extremely mild because Elizabeth was absolutely kind of in command of herself, but it is enough to horrify her. Whether it was even holding hands, whatever it was enough to horrify her. So she again rededicates herself to making sure this friendship is chaste. It is chaste. I've got no doubt about that. It is also romantic. You cannot read these letters, including letters she wrote to him after their arrival in New York, and not feel that kind of her desire to find a new home, to make sure this faith is her true faith, is all caught up in her love for Antonio. So it's just, I mean, it's just, it's complicated in a really human way, right? It's hard to categorize, but it was intense. So, and of course, you know, people pick up on this. They don't suspect an affair. And again, there's no physical affair here, but they see the romance of it. They just see that this Italian has come back with their beloved Elizabeth, and her husband is dead, and now she's a Catholic. And so they can try to convince her that she's just been sort of, you know, hornswoggled by these people. And when she gets over her grief and Antonio backs away, she will again become a good Protestant. And in fact, Antonio backs away immediately. He is married. He does not want trouble. He sees that he is, if anything, harming the prospects of Elizabeth converting. So he actually hightails it to Boston as soon as he can. And then Elizabeth is left with this months and months of kind of agonizing over whether her family and minister are right and she should become a Protestant again, or whether her own kind of internal spiritual inclination is right and she should really be Catholic.
What is Hobart's reaction?
Ugh, Hobart is heartbroken and betrayed. So Hobart, again, had been this kind of slightly, well, more than slightly controversial figure in Trinity Parish, which is still this, right, gorgeous Episcopalian church in the very downtown part of Manhattan near what was the World Trade Center. So for Hobart, Elizabeth Seton had become a kind of spiritual collaborator in a very sincere way, in a somewhat more strategic way. She was also a legitimation of his efforts, right? She was this respected matron who absolutely believed in his ministership. And to add the final wrinkle to it, I mentioned that Hobart's Episcopalianism was liturgically rich and respected the clergy. Well, a criticism that some fellow Episcopalians launched against him was that his Episcopalianism was too close to Catholicism. Well, my goodness, now his primary follower actually becomes a Catholic. So the whole thing could not have been worse as he saw it. And he wrote a very long, treatise, right? It's handwritten. He's got stuff crossed out. It just feels like something someone wrote passionately, almost desperately, explaining to her that Catholicism was barbaric, it was superstitious, it was grotesque, right? He sees transubstantiation, the idea that God is present in the Eucharist, as gross. Who believes that anymore, right? This is Hobart's view. And he just expends all kind of energy trying to get her back into the fold of Episcopalianism. And of course, he fails.
So how does she begin to define herself as a Catholic? How does she become Mother Seton?
Yeah. So she, after a long period of agonizing and realizing kind of within herself that the way Catholicism offered then a kind of material culture, it offered the culture of the saints, even gestures like the sign of the cross, which she had been unfamiliar with. Catholicism, to her, brings heaven to earth in a way that the Protestantism that she knew had not. So that is an immense part of the appeal. But she admits that another part of the appeal is that Catholic claims that they were the only safe path to salvation are actually just made more ferociously. than Protestant claims. And so it's a sort of a variant of Pascal's wager. She kind of thinks, well, if I can't be sure, I will just believe the Catholics because they seem more sure than anybody else that this is the way to go. So she kind of, at that moment, after a lifetime believing in reason, abandons reason, or says, reason has taken me this far, faith will have to take me the rest of the way, and my faith is going to be in the church. So she becomes Catholic, but she becomes, and she's Orthodox, but throughout the rest of her life, she seeks out priests who are kindred, right? She does not, she never simply accepts whatever priest is in the vicinity. She is entirely uninterested in the papacy. Now, it's a tough period for the papacy, right? Because one pope after another, quite literally, is taken captive, and communication in general is difficult. But her Catholicism is very much centered on, even on scripture, right? It emerges out of her Protestant upbringing, individual response to scripture, right? She doesn't give that up. When she becomes a Catholic, she finds priests quite assertively who she finds to be good spiritual collaborators, and she continues to take great delight in the culture of the saints, in religious pictures and objects, in feast days, right? In these kind of human cultural offerings that Catholicism made. And she is delighted when priests help her to create a religious community in which she can act as a what we call a woman religious. So, like, it's kind of like a nun, but not cloistered, right? It's not technically a nun, although outsiders would call them nuns. She takes a vow of poverty, chastity, obedience, but she is able to have her five children near her, even within this religious community. So she's able to become Mother Seton, as you said, capital M Mother, right? This leader of religious community, but she also remains little M Mother. She's able to continue mothering her own children at the same time.
Would you consider her a mystic?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I think she is much more of a mystic than she's given credit for, because historians have a tendency to put people in buckets. And there's a bucket for pious women, and in that bucket is the idea of benevolence work, right? That pious women in the United States are outward directed. Seton absolutely founded a community that was outward directed, that did enormous amounts of benevolence work and continues to. But left to her own devices, she was a contemplative, and she increasingly sort of immersed herself in Christ's suffering, in the idea of the brokenness of all creation, in the kind of sorrow and beauty of accepting humanity's sinfulness, and through that acceptance, having this kind of boundless gratitude toward God, which then could circle back and enable her to have a boundless love for the other sinful creatures. But her activism, her kind of social work, really had to work through that contemplative, mystical pathway in order to be energized.
This time period, this I'd say 1800 to 1820, it saw a rise in the Protestant world of women becoming active in social reform as well, correct?
Absolutely, yes, absolutely correct. So that this is kind of a part of the Second Great Awakening. And people sort of flinch, historians flinch when I say that, because the Second Great Awakening is about Protestantism. And it is in the main, right? But Elizabeth Seton and some of the women who joined her, some of whom were converts, right, are also looking for a more intense form of Christianity. in the way that other participants in the Second Great Awakening who tended to invent or find new forms of Protestantism were as well. And the other thing that she kind of benefits from is that after the cosmopolitan sort of philosophically inquiring period of the revolution ended, there began to be more suspicion of, say, deism, right, or the idea of kind of a distant God who doesn't intervene in human affairs, and more suspicion of what we might now call secularism than of Catholicism even. So that Seton, as a matron, right, as a mother, as someone who doesn't look like one of those scary nuns who people found so alienating, could be this wonderfully respectable face for Catholicism in a country that, as we talked about, still had this kind of cultural mistrust of that religion.
In the academic interest of always asking or seeking to ask and discover and stimulate new questions, is there a line to be investigated that says there was a Catholic branch off of the Second Great Awakening?
I would love to see that. Yes, absolutely. You know, did Catholic practices change? And you see priests writing to each other that, my goodness, you know, they're having a revival near us. We must respond, right? And a priest whom Elizabeth worked closely with and who could never quite master English, she was French, would have her help him write his sermons. And he knew perfectly well that he needed to, as he thought of it, attract people to the communion rail, right? Which is absolutely kind of a piece with the Second Great Awakening's revivalism. And you see converts to Catholicism who are making this choice. So yes, I would love to see professors and graduate students exploring that avenue.
Excellent. So a question we always ask, and I could go on this line of questioning for 6 hours, but I'm not going to keep you all day. And I'd love to have you back on, and maybe we can talk about Catholics moving into the antebellum period at some point if you're interested.
Yeah. Great, I'd love to.
And of course, we'd love to hear about the history of the Jesuits. But the road to now, our mission statement is that the individual's narrative is influenced by and tied up with and influences the historical narrative. And so How did you become interested in this discipline of study?
Oh, what a wonderful question. So I was brought up Catholic, was always fascinated by saints, although I had more of a taste for the medieval ones who, you know, smelled like roses after they died, right? The sort of classically amazing, miraculous saints, and Elizabeth Seton was more of a background figure. When I started my academic career, my academic life was entirely separate from that kind of spiritual questioning or tradition that I had come out of. And I wrote very happily about literature. When I was finishing that project, I was teaching a small class. I was doing a postdoc at William & Mary, and I was teaching it through biography. And a young woman said, I want to write about Mother Seton. And I thought, well, there must be 1,000 biographies of Mother Seton. And I was interested to find out that there were not. And as I looked more into this, I realized that her sainthood had kind of repelled scholarly inquiry in a way, that she wasn't understood as a woman. She certainly wasn't understood as a career woman, as someone who had founded this important institution. And when she did turn up in historical narratives, it was purely as a kind of a benevolence worker. It wasn't disrespectful, but it was very kind of separate. So I thought I'd do, you know, as one does, I'll write an article about this in 6 months. You know, 10 years later, I finished the book. But as I worked my way through it, I found immense, I would almost use the word solace in participating in her lifetime of inquiry and and seeing her ask the questions that she asks and seeing her wrestle even with things like pluralism, right? Like, how was she supposed to make her very single, what became a single-minded faith? How was she supposed to live in harmony with others who didn't share that faith? And as I worked in these archives, I also was exposed to the women who ran these archives, who tended to either be sisters of charity or have connections to that world, and just was so personally moved and humbled and enriched by their understanding of Elizabeth Seton, by their life in community, and by their absolute confidence in saying, "Catherine, you research everything. There are no boundaries, because Elizabeth Seton was a wonderful woman and a force of good in the world, and there is nothing you can do as a scholar that will threaten our understanding of that." And they were absolutely right. So it remained an academic project, but it also became this deeply kind of, again, I just come back to the word humbling, humbling and fulfilling path to walk with people from the past through the documents, and also with these wonderful kind of women of now, right? To use your podcast phrasing, who are still living in community with her and still asking these questions and coming up with these extraordinarily generous, spiritually rich answers.
There are some great historians of American religion and historians of the church in the United States right now, mm-hmm. but some of them aren't religious. They're historians of Christianity in America, but they're not Christians. Do you mm-hmm. think it adds, or, you know, I'm taking historical methods right now, right?
So
I have learned that bias is in selecting your topic. There's bias in selecting mm-hmm. your topic. Mm-hmm. Do you think it adds to a religious historical work for the academic to share in that faith, or do you think that someone who doesn't share in the faith can be more objective about it, more detached?
Anyone can study anything, right? This is my view, and the past is a foreign country, right? My kind of starting point is that any person of the present is so distant from people of the past, even when we might feel we have gender connections, ethnic connections, denominational connections. So I feel strongly about that. I also feel that faith is something that can be overlooked very easily, even when it was central to the people that were studying, and it's hard to see, it's hard to describe, and it can be awkward to write about when you're coming out of a social science tradition. But it is utterly unfaithful, maybe that's not the best word, but it's utterly unfaithful to the past not to take faith seriously, right? Not to see it as a force in an individual life, as a force in the world, like hunger, right? Like the quest for power, right? Like all these other things that we acknowledge. And it may be that that it is easier for some people to take faith more seriously than others, you know, but it has to be, it should be studied seriously as a force in the world, in a way that it often isn't. And I would want everyone to do that. And I guess I'm kind of agnostic on the question of who is best going to succeed.
You know, you mentioned earlier that there was this period of deism during the revolution, which we can associate with the Enlightenment, I guess. And then there was the Second Great Awakening, and there was this like period of like a fever of religion swept the country, if you will. And then if we look at, like, again, right now I'm viewing everything through historical methodologies. So you have these social theories like Marxism and gender theories. And then you have the rise of cultural theories that again look at, take religion seriously, where Marxism or gender theories don't mm-hmm. so much look at religion, and then cultural theories do, kind of the religion is worth investigating. And now are we in this postmodern period? And where does religion fit into historical inquiry?
Yeah. It should be everywhere in a sense. I mean, maybe in a way analogous to gender, right? So that one of the things that gender scholars taught us was that even works that are not pitching themselves as explicitly about gender must understand that women play a role, must understand that gendered language plays a role, right? And I think it would be valuable if we are approaching a moment in which, for example, someone studying labor unions in the 20th century would just think it necessary to ask, how did the social gospel movement intersect with labor movements? How did Jesuits, right, how did Jesuits who ran labor schools intersect with that, even if their primary focus were not religion? And I would say even more assertively, I would hope that the idea that religion is simply a cover for something that's real, right? That that religion is superstructural, or that if someone says they're doing for something for religious purposes, really underneath that is an actual motive. I would hope that that kind of analysis is largely discredited, or you would have to prove it, right? The assumption couldn't be that the religious motive was insincere. You would need to offer evidence that the religious motive was insincere, as you would need to offer evidence that any other motive was insincere. So I guess I see it as something that would be valuable in every study, and as well as something that can be the center of, you know, a certain number of scholarly works. And I try to convince my colleagues of that with varying degrees of success.
Well, we covered so much in this interview, and I feel like we left out so much more. So we need to do it again. The book is Elizabeth Seton, American Saint. You can pick it up wherever fine books are sold. And also you can download it from Libro.fm. Do you know what Libro.fm is?
I do not.
Libro.fm is one of the sponsors of our program, but more importantly, they are similar to the other major site where you would download an audiobook. But great, if you join Libro.fm and you purchase American Saint, they will ask you what independent bookstore you want to send a portion of your payment to. So you sign
that
up.
That is amazing.
You get a membership to Libro. You sign up your local bookstore that you love and you want to support. And every time you get a book on Libro, some of those proceeds go to your favorite local bookstore.
That is wonderful. We have this bookstore changing hands in Tempe. That's brilliant. So I will do this.
You need to do it. And that is where I downloaded your book. And so it is there, and so excited.
Great.
I hope everyone, I didn't want to get you to tell us everything about Mother Seton, because I want our listeners to go buy the book and read it for themselves. But thank you so much, Catherine O'Donnell.
Oh, this was such a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
As you do for the least of days.